Tonight we're really fortunate to have Professor Elizabeth Gould from Princeton University in New Jersey. Elizabeth is a New Yorker, although claims Scottish ancestry. Her great-grandmother was from Glasgow, and her dad plays the bagpipes, so we'll adopt her for the time she's here. Studied psychology in New York and ended her PhD at UCLA in California. Worked more recently with Professor Bruce McEwen, and many of you here I know will have been at Bruce McEwen's lecture a couple of years ago in this series. And that fascinating bit of work has really inspired quite a lot of research since. Now tonight, Elizabeth is going to talk to this title, Positive and Negative Stress Altered Brain Structure. And I recall when I was a medical student being told that when you were born, you had all the brain cells you were ever going to get. Once you were born, it was all downhill from there on. And we used to speculate in the beer bar at the university as to how many brain cells we would knock off per pint of McEwen's 80 shilling we drank. And at the end of it, trying to count up how many brain cells cured we had in the company. It's quite clear that that idea of a static brain just doesn't apply anymore, that the brain, as we saw from Bruce, changes its shape and its structure. And we're going to hear much more about that tonight. So, before we start, mobile phones, please, if you've got it switched on, as I have, I think, after a minute. And over to you, Elizabeth.
Thanks very nice for that kind introduction and for the invitation to speak today. Thanks for everyone here for coming to hear what I have to say. I don't have a pointer, so I will use my finger, which is not on a long enough arm, but I'll try to give you an indication of where I want you to look. The title of my talk is Positive and Negative Stress Alter Brain Structure. And I'm going to be talking about different types of experiences which activate stress hormone systems and how they impact the adult brain. And then I'd like to give you some clues about how experiences that occur during postnatal life, during early life, set the stage for the response to those types of experiences later on. And overall, the message is good. There's a downside to a lot of what stress does to the brain, but really what we've seen over the past 15 years or so in studying structural plasticity in the adult mammalian brain is that the adult brain is very resilient. And even in cases where negative developmental influences alter the brain, if the environment is changed in adulthood, we can see a lot of a reversal of those negative effects. So overall, I would say that the take-home message is positive. How to implement that is a complicated, the positive environment is a much more complicated story. Now, most of what I'm going to be talking about today comes from work on experimental animals, because the types of measures that we're interested in making can't be done non-invasively yet. I mean, we have a lot of hope with imaging studies as they gain in resolution that these kinds of questions can be answered directly in humans, but for the time being, we've been doing our work in experimental animals, we have a lot of reason to believe that much of what we've seen in experimental animals is generalizable to humans, largely due to the fact that we've seen many of these phenomena over and over again in different mammalian species, including in several species of non-human primates. Okay, so that's just sort of by way of background. I'm going to be talking not just about adult neurogenesis or the production of new neurons, but also about other kinds of structural change. So the modification of the dendritic tree and also the numbers of connections between neurons, and I'll give you more details about that in a moment. So I'm going to begin by giving you a little bit of background about structural plasticity in the adult mammalian brain, and then I'd like to get into how experience modulates brain structure in adulthood. give you sort of the positive and negative side of that story, because many experiences which activate stress hormone systems are actually considered to be rewarding. I'll give you some very obvious examples of them that we've explored in the laboratory. And then talk to you a bit about how development can shape brain structure and how that impacts the adult response. So this this first slide shows three panels taken from a confocal laser scanning microscope of fluorescent brain images. And this is just to give you an idea of the kinds of things that we look at and the types of structural change that we know occur in adulthood. On the left-hand side, that's a neuron, a pyramidal neuron in the neocortex, and it's stained with a fluorescent dye called dye-I. And we know that in many different circumstances, the dendritic tree, which is these extensive processes that extend out of the cell body that receives the majority of synaptic input from other neurons, that the dendritic tree can change its shape and size in response to experience. One of the dendritic segments is enlarged in this middle panel, and you can see these protuberances along it, and those are called dendritic spines. Those are primary sites of excitatory input or synapses, and we know that the size, number, and shape of dendritic spines can be modulated by experience and hormones. And then finally, on the right-hand side, we have examples of neurons that were generated in the adult brain. I'm going to be focusing most, but not all, of my talk on that process of adult neurogenesis. And the new neurons in this panel are shown with this green fluorescent dye, and those are located in the hippocampus, which is the brain region I'll be focusing extensively on today. This is another example of some microscopic images showing new neurons in the adult hippocampus. This was taken from a rat, and in this case, the new neurons are shown in red, and you can see this sort of speckled staining of fluorescent red on the top panel. Those are a relatively large collection of cells that were produced in adulthood, and down below you can see the green stain shows that some of those cells have differentiated into neurons. And there's a lot of good evidence, and I'll summarize a bit of it, that the cells that are generated in the adult hippocampus do become functional neurons, or the majority of them do. First, I'd like to establish the basis of my claim that this is a phenomenon that's relevant to humans. So the earliest papers that provided evidence for adult neurogenesis in the hippocampus of mammals were published in the 1960s. And these were published, these were studies that were done by a neurobiologist named Joseph Altman and his colleagues. And he demonstrated adult neurogenesis in the hippocampus and some other brain regions in the rat. Subsequently, this was shown by many other investigators after a period of several decades in the mouse, as well as replicated in the rat. And this was work that I did in collaboration with Bruce McEwen in the early 1990s. So we essentially rediscovered this work that had been published many decades ago, but not recognized by the neuroscience community, probably for a large number of reasons that we can talk about later in the question and answer period if anyone is really interested in that. So by the point of the early 1990s, we were pretty convinced that there was adult neurogenesis in the hippocampus of rodents. But the question remained whether this was a phenomenon that you'd see in more complex animals. So in collaboration with Everhard Fuchs and Bruce McEwen, we looked at the tree shrew and indeed found a substantial amount of adult neurogenesis there. That's a tree shrew over on the right-hand side. And then we moved into the study of non-human primates and looked at the New World monkey, a marmoset, which is shown here in the lower right-hand panel, and saw the same phenomenon, a large number of new neurons generated in the hippocampus in adulthood. And finally, we looked at macaque monkeys, which are old world monkeys, relatively closely related to humans, and saw the same phenomenon. One study since that time, done by Fred Gage and Peter Erickson, has demonstrated that there's adult neurogenesis in the hippocampus of humans. And this was work that was done in cancer patients that were treated in a way so that the new neurons could be marked, like what I showed you with those microscopic images. It was a method that was used to label the proliferating index of their tumors, which were not in the brain. And then after these individuals died, their brains were donated to research, and it was established that there was adult neurogenesis in the hippocampus. So we have very limited data about humans so far, and we're not certain whether adult neurogenesis occurs in all humans. So we're going to put a big question mark there. But we know that at least for the majority of old, even sick and dying individuals, there's substantial adult neurogenesis. Not even sure we're interested in answering that previous question. So we know that there's evidence for new neurons in the hippocampus, not just because we see that they're produced in adulthood and they look like new neurons, but we also know that they receive synapses on their cell bodies and dendrites. They also extend dendrites and axons into target regions. We know that they generate action potentials, and they express neuronal-specific proteins. And this is another example of a collection of neurons that were generated in the adult hippocampus. This time, the stain that tells us that it's new is shown in green, and the red stain shows that the cell has differentiated into a neuron and has grown dendritic processes. So the evidence now is very strong, and not just for rodents, but also for primates. So we ask the question, how many new neurons are produced in adulthood? And I think this is a very important question for establishing functional significance, because if it's just a few cells, it's less likely that those cells would have any impact. And it turns out that there is a substantial amount of adult neurogenesis in the hippocampus. And I'll give you some really detailed quantitative information from the rodent in a moment. But because, you know, of course, we're very interested in how this is relevant to humans, I'm going to start with the quantitative picture by talking about marmosets, which, as I said, are New World monkeys, and they're more closely related to humans, of course, than rodents are. And then I'm going to tell you how the human data, which is limited but quantitative, maps onto this picture, and then give you an idea about the rodent as well. And I want to give you the take-home message of this little part right now is that there doesn't seem to be a big difference in the numbers of new neurons that are produced across mammalian species. So increasing complexity of brain anatomy and function doesn't seem to be necessarily linked to a decline in structural plasticity. So this is work that a postdoc in my lab, Ben Luner, did. She looked at marmosets at different ages, and what she found was that the numbers of new neurons produced in the hippocampus declined steadily with advancing age. And this is something that wasn't too surprising to us because it had already been shown in rodents. But you can see that this decline begins in around midlife, and that also seems to be about the time when you can first start to detect cognitive impairments. Most of us, I mean, I was sad to read this, actually, because most of us, I think, are under the impression that cognitive impairment is something that shows up in, you know, only when you reach the elderly status, but it starts much earlier. In fact, you can pick it up in humans right after, in the 30s. And when a marmoset is essentially in midlife, or 30s to 50s, you see this big decrease in adult neurogenesis. And by the time a marmoset is considered to be aged, the numbers are much, much lower than in a young adult. So what's going on with the humans? As I told you, the only strong quantitative data we have with humans comes from this cancer study, where the patients were all relatively old and very sick. So it's actually pretty remarkable that any adult neurogenesis was detectable in these individuals, because, as I'll tell you in a moment, adult neurogenesis is very much suppressed by negative stress. And obviously, you know, suffering from an illness is very stressful. And yet, if you look at those data and map them onto this marmoset study, you see that the human has at least as many, if not more, than what we see in the marmoset. And this little asterisk shows this one data point from the Erickson and Gage paper looking at a 72-year-old individual who's dying of cancer. And we picked that data point to put on here because that is the one that's the most closely linked to the paradigm that we used for the marmoset. And if anyone wants details of that later on, I'll be happy to give them to you. So you see there's a substantial amount, even in the aged human. And because we've seen this in many species, rats, mice, tree shrews, dogs, and marmosets, this decline with advanced age in adult neurogenesis, it's reasonable to suspect that the young adult human would have many, many more new neurons than this aged, sick, and dying human did. And if we look at what the rat is generating in terms of new neurons in the hippocampus at this around the same age, it's very similar to the human. So I think, you know, with the caveat that we have limited data in the humans, the data that we do have, I think it's important to note that it doesn't appear to be a decline in humans, certainly not in primates overall, in the rate of adult neurogenesis. Okay, so now we can ask the question, in species that we have more quantitative data on, how many new neurons are produced in adulthood, and we're talking just about the hippocampus here. And Heather Cameron and Ron Mackay did a very elegant study in young adult rats, and they quantified the total numbers of neurons that were produced every day, and they found that it's more than 9,000 new neurons that are produced every day, and given the fact that the type of neuron that's generated in the adult rat, there's about between 1.5 to 2 million, this represents a significant proportion of the neurons that are generated in adulthood. It extrapolates to about 250,000 per month. And again, there's a decline with advanced age, but in the young adult, it's really a substantial cohort of cells that are added every day. So some of you may be wondering, how is it possible for the adult brain to make all these new neurons and for this brain region not to get too big for the rest of the brain or for the skull? And it turns out that there's a lot of death, cell death, in this area. There's a significant amount of turnover. And the turnover of the cells is modulated by experience, and I'll give you some examples of that in a moment. So the neurons are not produced at these high rates, and all of them integrate permanently into the existing neural circuitry. It's only a percentage of them that do, and there seems to be a continual turnover, production of new neurons and the death of some of those cells. Okay, so I want to talk now specifically about the hippocampus and how experience modulates not just the incorporation of new neurons into this brain structure, but also how experience modulates the dendritic architecture and dendritic spines of the pre-existing neurons. So we know a lot about the hippocampus relative to many other brain regions. It's been extensively studied specifically because of its role in certain types of learning and memory. But it also has some lesser known functions in anxiety regulation and also in feedback of the stress response. And so we're very interested in understanding how these structural changes that occur under normal circumstances in the hippocampus contribute to the learning and memory as well as the anxiety and stress regulation functions of the hippocampus. And that's been a major focus of the work in our lab. We know that many different types of experience can modulate adult neurogenesis as well as modulate dendritic architecture. And this is just a partial list of some of these identified experiences that we know have a big impact on adult neurogenesis. I'm going to focus most of my talk today on stress and two very related experiences related to stress, social dominance and physical exercise. Because we don't tend to think of physical exercise as stressful, but it turns out that it has a profound effect on the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, which is a major stress hormone system. We also know that environmental complexity, learning, and parenting have a major impact on adult neurogenesis and dendritic architecture in adulthood. A lot of our work is focused on that. I'm only going to touch very briefly on environmental complexity as it pertains to the reversal of stress effects toward the end of my talk. We've done a lot of work on these other types of experiences, so I encourage anyone who's interested to ask me about that later on. So we all know that there are individual differences in response to stress. And this is true not just in humans, but also in experimental animals. Some individuals respond to stress by developing psychopathology, depression, or anxiety disorders. Others respond to aversive stressors with resilience. And still others thrive on what the majority of people consider to be stressful experiences, they actually seek them out and find them to be rewarding. And, you know, individual differences really are a hallmark of the human experience in response to stress. And we do see some of that in experimental animal populations as well. But we can look at individual differences in response to stress by selecting different types of stressors and modulating the context in which they're applied as well. So what determines individual responses to stress? There are many different factors that determine whether one person has a positive or a negative response to this, essentially the same experience. Obviously, psychological variables come into play, whether the stressor is controllable or predictable. Those seem to lessen the negative impact of stressors. The emotional valence of the stressor is also very important, whether or not the individual finds the experience to be aversive or rewarding. And a really good example of this, I think, in humans is physical exercise. So I'll talk about this in a moment when we discuss what we know from work of experimental animals. We know that rodents love to run on wheels. It's a universally motivating experience. If you give a rodent, a rat or a mouse, a running wheel, they'll run for several kilometers a night unless they're on death's door. That's not true for humans. In fact, many humans in my country, you know, we wouldn't have an obesity epidemic if that was the case. But many humans find physical exercise to be aversive. And so I think this is a really key point, and we're trying to tap into this into the laboratory. Whether or not the experience, independent of how it elevates stress hormone systems, whether or not the experience is viewed as rewarding versus aversive. This seems to have a major, be a major determinant of whether the effects of that experience are positive or negative. Next, we know that the social context can modulate the outcome in terms of stress effects on structural plasticity. When the social context is positive, and even a stressful experience can have a positive effect on brain growth. When the social context is negative, in cases of subordination or isolation stress, and another stressor is applied to that, the effects are most negative. And I'll give you some examples of that. And of course, developmental history seems to play a big role in whether or not the response to a stressful experience is positive or negative in terms of its long-term outcome. So I want to give you a brief overview of the kinds of experiences that we study in the laboratory, because we need to operationalize stress when we're studying this in experimental animals. And in order to do so, we have to pick well-controlled stressors that we know something about the physiology, the physiological effects. And this is just a partial list of some of the commonly used types of experiences that are examined in the field. On the left-hand side, I've put a list of negative stressors, and we define negative stress as experiences that are punishing or aversive. So if animals are given the opportunity, they will try to escape from that. They'll either show freezing or immobilization behavior, so they induce fear, or if they're given the opportunity, they'll escape. And in that list, there's included social subordination, physical pain, restraint, and predator odor exposure in the case of rodents. On the right-hand side, we have a list of positive stressors, which are considered to be rewarding or motivating. And again, this is for experimental animals. Sexual behavior seems to be universally rewarding to experimental animals, as is eating and running. And you know, they're listed here and characterized as stressors because of the fact that they activate the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, which is a major stress hormone system, which leads to the increasing glucocorticoid hormones in the bloodstream. So, you know, some of you may be a little surprised that the positive, the experiences that are listed on the positive side actually are stressful in terms of hormone response, but the results are really quite dramatic. And I'll give you some examples in a moment. Sexual behavior causes an increase in glucocorticoid levels, which is far exceeds what we see when an animal is exposed to subordination stress. And that's really, I think, sort of counterintuitive, but very interesting, because it suggests that the brain is somehow buffered from the negative effects of high levels of glucocorticoids when the stress is rewarding. So I want to focus for a moment on the negative side of the story and then give you more of the positive information, because that's our newest data, and I think it also raises some really interesting questions. So this is work that I started back when I was working with Bruce McEwen at the Rockefeller University and continued in my laboratory at Princeton to the present day. We've been looking at the influence of aversive stressors on adult neurogenesis and the dentigyrus is a part of the hippocampus that we see in most of the adult neurogenesis. And we've seen now that there's a very long list, this is just partial list, of the numbers of different kinds of stressors that inhibit adult neurogenesis. And this can be seen when the stress is acute, as well as when the stress is chronic. And this partial list includes predator odor, subordination, restraint stress, electric shock, and sleep deprivation. They all decrease the numbers of new neurons that are produced in the hippocampus. And this is just one example of one data set. This was work done by Pat Tanapat, a grad student in the lab, and she showed that when rats are exposed to the main component of fox feces, trimethylthiazolone, there's a natural stress response that increases the levels of glucocorticoids. So the graph on the left-hand side shows the amount of corticosterone in the blood of these animals, and corticosterone is the main glucocorticoid stress hormone in rodents. And you see it increases when the animals are exposed to this predator odor. And on the right-hand side, she has graphed the numbers of new neurons in the hippocampus, and there's an increase in glucocorticoids and a decrease in neurogenesis. And she did subsequent studies to link these two by clamping the levels of stress hormones in animals that were exposed to the predator odor, and she completely eliminated the neurogenesis effect. So there's good reason to believe that these two findings are causally linked, that the elevation in glucocorticoids is what is responsible for slowing the neuron growth. Okay, and again, similar effects have been observed with other aversive stressors and in other species. We've seen suppression of neurogenesis in response to aversive stress in rats, mice, tree shrews, and marmosets thus far. It's also been demonstrated in the cats. There's good reason to believe that this would occur in humans as well. So we were interested in studying this phenomenon of stress effects on neurogenesis in a more naturalistic environment. And we were also very curious to evaluate dominance hierarchies because of our interest in subordination stress. So we adopted a paradigm that was first developed by the Blanches at the University of Hawaii. And this paradigm is called the visible burrow system. And this is a schematic diagram of the visible burrow system, and you're sort of looking down on the top. It's just a very large enclosure. And two sides of this contain tunnels and chambers for the rodents to run, sleep, and hide. And then there's an open field area where the animals have to come in order to gain access for to food and water. And this is a very useful paradigm because when we put experimental animals in groups into this setting, they form very potent dominance hierarchies. One animal emerges as the dominant, it's the more aggressive animal, and the other animals become subordinate. And in most cases, with most groups of rats, which is the species we looked at here, the dominance hierarchy becomes relatively stable after the third night. So I want to give you an example of some of the behavior that we witnessed and how we characterize this, because it really is quite obvious which animal is the dominant. So I have a little videotape here. And you'll see these animals have different markings spray painted on their back. They're albino animals, so they're usually just white. But in order to quantify their behavior, we spray paint different markings on their back. So the dominant in this cohort has the most dark painted on his back. And you see he's boxing with the other rats in the field and chasing them out, generally harassing them all night long. This is work that Zhenya Kozorovitsky, a grad student in the lab, did. She was curious to see whether the dominants made a different number of new neurons than the subordinates. And we had predicted originally that the subordinates would make fewer than the dominants, but the dominants would be like the controls, because we predicted that the subordinates would be stressed. And it turned out that she saw something not altogether different than what was predicted, but not exactly what we expected. She found that the dominants produced more new neurons than the subordinates, but that the subordinates did not produce fewer neurons than the control animals. And this is a graph showing the numbers of new neurons in the hippocampus, and the three different bars represent the cage control animals, so the animals that were not living in a dominance hierarchy, that's the crosshatched bar, the dominant animals, that's the black bar, and the subordinate animals, which is the white bar. And you can see that the dominant animals make more new neurons than either of the other two groups. This is after just 3 nights of living in a dominance hierarchy, living as a dominant. And remember, these animals were not living in dominance hierarchies before the start of the experiment. And we have good reason to believe that this is a difference in adult neurogenesis that was induced by the social context. When the animals were put into the visible burrow system and some of them emerged as dominants, they began to make more new neurons than they had previously. And the reason we think this is the case is because if you examine the variance between the white and the black bar, it's really tremendous relative to what we typically see in the cage controls. So it looks like having these varied experiences, even in the same setting, really brings out individual differences in brain growth. And that's a very complex setting, the visible burrow system. So we're very interested in sort of teasing apart the variables in order to identify what was responsible for elevating neurogenesis in the dominants. And one of the things that we noticed was that the dominant animals have more access to the females, so they actually mate more frequently than the subordinate animals do, because the subordinate animals spend most of their time running away from the dominants, hiding, and trying to get food and water without getting beat up. So what we did next was we tested in animals that were not living in the visible burrow system, specifically the influence of sexual experience on brain growth. And this was work that Erica Glasper, a postdoc in the lab, did. So she looked at the amount of neurogenesis in the hippocampus, and she also looked at the levels of circulating glucocorticoids, just like what I showed you with the predator odor exposure experiment, but this time it's a different kind of stressor. And if you look on the right-hand side, this is the levels of glucocorticoids. There's a huge increase with sexual experience. The yellow bar is the animals that have the sexual experience. The gray bar are naive animals. And this is really a whopping increase in glucocorticoids. As I said, it's more than twice what we see in a time-matched exposure to an aggressive male in a subordinate encounter. And obviously, this is a positive experience for these animals because they develop a place preference for the location of a sexually receptive female. They'll also learn to press a bar very readily in order to gain access to a female, and they obviously find it very rewarding. And on the left-hand side, we see that surprisingly, there's an increase in neurogenesis, despite the fact that glucocorticoid levels are so high. And this was really a surprising result to us, because we had seen over and over again that elevated glucocorticoids were associated with the suppression of neuron growth. And we're presently trying to identify the factors that are responsible for this. But clearly, it's an indication that when stress hormone systems are activated in the context of a rewarding experience, the brain is buffered against the negative effects of glucocorticoids. And we think that one possible factor that buffers the brain and causes an increase in neuron growth instead of a decrease are endogenous opiates, which are elevated under almost all rewarding conditions. And that's one of the things we're looking at in the lab, but we don't have the data on that yet. Another universally rewarding behavior for rodents is running. And I told you a bit about this before when I was introducing the concept of individual differences. We know that healthy rats will run several kilometers a night if they're given access to a running wheel. They'll develop a place preference for a running wheel, and they'll readily learn to bar press for access to a running wheel. We also know that running activates the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, so it causes increases in glucocorticoids. And it also, just like what we've observed with sexual experience, enhances adult neurogenesis. But there's a caveat here. Something that really needs to be noted, and that's that running only enhances adult neurogenesis when it occurs in a positive social context. And when animals are running in a negative social context, at least in the short term, it has a negative effect on neurogenesis. I'll tell you a bit about that in the next few slides. This is work that Alexis Stranahan, a grad student in my lab at Princeton, did. She asked the question of whether social housing affects the response to a positive stressor, and in this case, the positive stressor was running. So she housed animals either individually or in groups, and she gave some of them access to a running wheel, and some of them were sedentary. And what she found was that there were elevations in glucocorticoid levels with running, whether the animals were housed individually or in groups. There was an activation of the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis in both cases, and in this particular experiment, on the left-hand side are the glucocorticoid values, and you can see that the group-housed animals have an even higher level of glucocorticoids than the individually housed animals when they're running. Although that's not a statistically significant effect, but they certainly don't have the reverse. And if you look at the graph on the right-hand side, this is the numbers of new neurons in the hippocampus. And if you look at the group-housed animals, that those are the bars on the right-hand side of the right-hand graph. The runners make more new neurons. The black bar is higher than the white bar when they're housed in groups. And the opposite effect is observed in the individually housed animals. When the individually housed animals run, there's actually a suppression of adult neurogenesis, just like what we see when we expose animals to predator odor, or cold swim, or restrained stress, or subordination. So there's obviously something about social housing that's, again, buffering the brain from the negative influence of glucocorticoids. So it turns out that although this first experiment that we did here on the left-hand side demonstrated that individually housed and group housed runners both had an increase in glucocorticoids, when we looked at many different time points of stress hormone levels, the effects were much more complicated than that. So that graph that was shown on the previous slide is on the upper left-hand side of this panel. Those are baseline glucocorticoid levels in control animals and runners housed individually and in groups. If we looked at different time points, when glucocorticoid levels were naturally lower because there's a diurnal rhythm to these hormones, what we see was that the group-housed animals actually had a lower level of glucocorticoids at that time point, and that's the graph on the upper right-hand panel. But what's most interesting, I think, is when we looked at baseline stress and recovery levels of glucocorticoids. So we took sedentary animals and animals that had been running for several weeks, and we restrained them and measured glucocorticoids in a baseline condition after the stress and after they had recovered from the stressor. And we saw that the group-housed runners did not mount a stress response. So they were actually buffered at the level of the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis from having an increase in glucocorticoids. And you can see that in the bottom graph on the right-hand side. All of the other groups showed with stress an increase in glucocorticoid levels. So each little cluster of three, the black bar, represents the stress level. And you can see the right-hand group, which is the group-housed runners, they don't have an increase in glucocorticoids in response to stress. So there is something that's different about the stress hormone system in these animals that, you know, at least in part, is contributing to their ability to undergo brain growth in response to an increase in glucocorticoids as opposed to a suppression of neurogenesis. Alexis went on to investigate whether glucocorticoids were responsible for these running effects on neurogenesis, and she did this by taking out the adrenal glands and clamping the levels of glucocorticoids so that the animals didn't have an increase or a decrease in glucocorticoids at different time periods in the diurnal rhythm. And what she found was that in so doing, she was able to prevent the decrease in neurogenesis in the individually housed runners. So she was able to prevent the negative effect, but she was not able to alter the positive effect of running on neurogenesis. And this suggests that there are other factors that are potentially involved in this, that something about running in a group enables the animal to provide some kind of a factor that enables the animal to produce more new neurons and to sort of bypass the negative effects of glucocorticoids. And again, here, we think a good candidate might be opiates, which are known to be increased in the brain in response to running. But there's some evidence that, that blocking opiate receptors might actually inhibit neurogenesis, but again, that's very preliminary. So here, I think the real take-home message and the interesting point about this set of studies that Dr. Stranahan did was that you can expose animals to what appears to be exactly the same experience, and depending upon the social context, you can get a completely different brain interpretation of that response. So in the animals that were living alone, we got the opposite effect. There was a negative effect of running on neurogenesis, whereas the animals that were living in groups, there was a positive effect on neurogenesis. And that's, you know, very probably there are pertinent examples that we could think of in human situations where social context would very much affect the one's ability to cope with a negative stressor. I want to give you sort of the broader picture as well. Running doesn't just alter neurogenesis, it affects dendritic architecture and dendritic spine density. Remember I told you those are the extensions off of dendritic segments that represent primary sites of excitatory synapses or connections between neurons. So we looked at populations of neurons that are not produced in adulthood and found that in every case of neurons in the hippocampal circuitry, running induced an increase in dendritic spine density or an increase in the numbers of connections between neurons. So there's a lot of brain growth that's going on. It's not just the addition of new neurons. And having the running in a positive social context obviously produces a greater beneficial effect. So we know that running alters hippocampal function. There are many, many studies that have shown this. Now this is just a partial list. Running alters, it actually enhances learning and memory functions. It also decreases anxiety in animals, and many people are using running in the laboratory in rodents as a model of antidepressant action. And there certainly is some evidence, although it's not as clear cut in humans, that physical activity can elevate mood. So we're very interested in understanding how these changes that occur in hippocampal structure in response to running and the other experiences that we've looked at contribute to changes in hippocampal function. And that's also a major focus of my lab now, is to try to find ways to block these structural changes to see whether the experience-driven changes in hippocampal function can be altered. And we don't know the answer to that question. It's actually a very broad question, but there's a lot of evidence that suggests that increases in the numbers of new neurons as well as increases in the numbers of dendritic spines are associated with improved performance on learning and memory tasks, at least in experimental animals. So I want to switch gears for the last part of my talk and discuss how early life experience might impact the brain's ability to respond to stress in adulthood. This was work done by Christian Marescu, a grad student in the lab, using the maternal separation paradigm, which was so well characterized by Gabe Levine and Michael Meany. And what it entails is actually taking rat pups away from the mother every day for 3 hours for the first two postnatal weeks of life. And this alters the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. And has it, you know, a sort of broad effect and lasting effect on certain behaviors. So it's a very interesting model of early life stress. And what Christian was interested in looking at is whether early life experience, insofar as it dysregulates the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, whether it would have a significant effect on adult neurogenesis. So we looked at animals that were undisturbed, the control animals, and he compared them to animals that were handled every day but returned immediately to the mothers. That's the gray bar. And then he looked at animals that were, as I just described, removed from the mother every day for for a significant amount of time, for a two-week period, and then returned back every day after the maternal separation period was over. And what he found was that the animals that were subjected to maternal separation, when they grew up to be adults, they made fewer new neurons in the hippocampus. And so this is a graph that again shows the numbers of new neurons in the hippocampus, and in both sets of three bars, you can see that the white bar, which represents the maternally separated animals, there are many fewer neurons that are produced in the hippocampus of those animals in comparison to the other two groups. You know, remember, these are adult animals that were subjected to the maternal separation paradigm during development. Okay, so this is a persistent effect. After the first two postnatal weeks of life are over, the animals are not disturbed any longer, and then the numbers of new neurons are examined in adulthood. So this early postnatal experience has a lasting effect on structural plasticity in adulthood. So one of the things that Christian was interested in looking at is whether or not the animals that make fewer new neurons to begin with have what we would characterize as a normal stress response to, in terms of suppression of adult neurogenesis in response to an aversive stressor. So he exposed these animals, these maternally deprived animals, to a predator odor in adulthood. And remember, I told you at the beginning of my talk that predator odor exposure suppresses adult neurogenesis. So we took maternally deprived animals when they became adults and subjected them to that same stressor. And he found that the maternally deprived animals had what appeared to be a normal glucocorticoid response. That's shown on the right-hand graph. Those are levels of glucocorticoids in control animals, in handled animals, and in maternally separated animals. The black bar in all cases is the control condition, and the white bar represents exposure to predator odor. And all three groups had a similar stress response. And yet, the effects on neurogenesis were really quite different. The control and the handled animals showed the characteristic suppression of neurogenesis in response to predator odor exposure, but the maternally separated animals showed no significant decrease, perhaps because their baseline was so low to begin with. They were not mounting this normal, what we would characterize as a normal response of adult neurogenesis to an aversive stressor. And you can see those data on the left-hand side. In particular, if I turn your attention to the in the two clusters of bars to the right-hand pair of black and white bars, you can see there are no significant differences between those two, and those are the maternally separated animals. Baseline level of adult neurogenesis is suppressed, but no further decrease with stress in adulthood. All of that can be reversed when glucocorticoid levels are lower. So even though these animals seem to have normal levels of glucocorticoids, there's something about the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis that's dysregulated. Perhaps the more of the hormone is getting into the brain, they might have different levels of glucocorticoid receptors. Whatever it is, they have an increased sensitivity to glucocorticoids, which makes them have a reduction in neurogenesis, even in the baseline. So the baseline animal, the unstressed animal, looks like a stressed animal. So this seems to be sort of bad news in general, and it looks like these effects are permanent, because we looked at animals that were a fully adult after this early life experience and found that there was a suppression of adult neurogenesis until these animals were in midlife. But what we were interested in seeing was whether experiences that we know have a positive effect on neurogenesis, whether they were capable of reversing these negative influences that were laid down during development. So we took animals that were subjected to maternal deprivation paradigm during early life and housed them in enriched environments in adulthood. This is an example of one of the enriched environments that was used that looks very similar to the visible burrow system, but in this case we did not set up the circumstances so that there were dominant and subordinate animals. We housed animals only in same-sex groups, so there was no competition for mating. We also made food and water readily available to the animals. And we gave them access to many interesting objects to explore and hid food throughout the enriched environment so that they would engage in natural foraging-like behaviors. And we know from other studies that living in an enriched environment stimulates adult neurogenesis in the hippocampus. And we were curious to see whether or not this would have the same effect on adult neurogenesis in maternally separated animals, or whether maternally separated animals were just more structurally rigid in both ends of the continuum. So they failed to show a suppression with stress, and perhaps they would fail to show a positive effect with enriched environment. And so that was the experiment that was done. And we found that indeed, the suppression of adult neurogenesis that occurs with maternal separation could be reversed by housing animals in enriched environment conditions in adulthood. So this graph shows the numbers of new neurons. On the left-hand side, these are the control animals. And the black bar represents animals that did not live in an enriched environment. The white bar represents animals that lived in an enriched environment. I turn your attention to the bars on the right-hand side that are labeled MS for maternal separation. The black bar is the control or non-enriched condition. You see they have a suppression in adult neurogenesis relative to the controls on the left-hand side. But living in an enriched environment restored that back to the normal level. So I think this is very encouraging indeed, because it suggests that even in cases where the developmental circumstances are negative and stress hormone systems are dysregulated, that the brain seems to be resilient enough in adulthood to respond in a positive way to a positive experience. And we don't know the extent of this resilience. We haven't yet looked at very long time points or other types of positive experiences, but we're certainly interested in doing that. And even more importantly, what we'd like to do is identify the mechanisms that underlie these effects. Because I think if we can identify those exact mechanisms, the factors that can stimulate neurogenesis in an animal that's been developed under conditions that suppress neurogenesis, then we can find other ways to stimulate brain growth. It's interesting and I think relevant in terms of the real world to look at experiences, but as I suggested early on in my talk, what one person's experience is in response to what we think is the same experience and compared to another person's experience varies dramatically. So understanding the mechanisms that promote neural growth, I think, will be a real key to harnessing this and figuring out how it can be used in order to improve brain function. So I'm going to conclude now and tell you what I hope are the key points that I got across today. First, the adult brain is structurally plastic, and I only gave you the tip of the iceberg of a huge literature on this now. We know that there's a vast array of structural changes that occur, and these changes don't occur just in response to damage. They occur under normal circumstances, in response to hormone fluctuations, as well as in response to experience. We know that the social context can determine the endocrine and neural response to stress, and we've extended this general idea to looking at the effects of stress on structural plasticity. And in fact, social context is so powerful that it can actually reverse the effects of stress on brain plasticity. And finally, developmental experience can alter the response of the brain to aversive stress, and some of these effects appear to be reversible by putting animals in more positive environments later on in life. Okay, I'm going to end there by thanking the people in my lab, past and present, without whom this work would not have been possible. Ben Luner, Erica Glasper, both postdocs in the lab now, did the work on marmosets as well as the sexual experience studies. Alexis Stranahan did all the work on running. Christian Marescu did the work on maternal separation, and Zhenya Kozorovitsky, the dominance hierarchy work. And the other individuals, of course, are equally important. They worked on a variety of the projects that I mentioned today. So thanks very much for your attention.